You're listening to the Belfer Center's Office Hours. This episode...
It's all I have known for 37 years, four as a cadet at West Point and 33 and a half as an officer.
Retired Army Major General William Rapp, former commandant of both the United States Military Academy and the U.S. Army War College, and currently the faculty chair of the Belfer Center's National Security Fellows Program. He talks about civilian-military relations, congressional oversight, and the biggest adjustments to civilian life. For more insightful conversations with experts from the Belfer Center and beyond, subscribe to Office Hours on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. Here's host, Arup Mukherjee.
Is there something that people may not expect from somebody like yourself who spent so much time in the military? Are you secretly a procrastinator? Are you actually not a morning person?
No, surprisingly, I'm actually very much a morning person, but I am in bed reading at about 9 p.m. Every night. So I go to bed much earlier than most people do, just because I have to get my, I need all the beauty rest I can get, frankly, but I am very much a morning person. For 33 years, I'm colorblind as a rock. I did not have to choose what to wear every day that I got up. And so one of the hardest parts about this transition to civilian life is figuring out what shirt and tie and jacket combinations go together every day. And sometimes they're not as successful as others.
So you're more stressed out in some sense. You have more stresses in your life, actually, as a civilian, as you did as a senior military officer.
Certainly in what I was going to wear every day.
So you have some serious academic creds. You have a master's. You got a master's in strategic studies at the U.S. Army War College. You also have a PhD from Stanford, which is a pretty serious place. And when people think of the military, at least popularly, it feels that there's this idea of brawn. It feels to me the primary image. But there's also brains in your background as well. And I was curious to know how those cultures balanced during your experience in the Army.
Yeah, I would say that education is a huge component of all the services. I'm not unique. I am for having a PhD, but almost all senior officers in all the services have at least a master's degree, at least one. They are sent to some of the top schools in the country to get those degrees because we don't want our thinking done by people who have no experience in the military, and we don't want our fighting done by people who have no interest in thinking. And so it is it's very important to all the services to be educated and to continue that. And this commitment to lifelong education is just hammered into every officer and enlisted men in any service.
And has that always been the case, or have you seen the culture change, and maybe this is academically or otherwise, in the Army since the 1980s when you entered service?
Well, no, it's always been. My father was in the Army. He was sent by the Army to get his master's degree. He did tremendous work at Livermore Labs back in the 60s on nuclear issues. It's not an aberration at all to have highly educated officer corps. In fact, it's seen as one of the strengths of our military.
Is there anything in the culture of the Army that you think, having served and now transitioned to civilian life, you think should change?
Oh yeah, there's always if you think that the organization that you're part of is perfect, you're probably deluding yourself to some of the things that could be better. Every organization can get better. We have personnel policies that we have to do better. How we relate to all demographics that join the military all has to be done better. And we're making great strides, but we're certainly always trying to be better at what we do. One of the things that that you might want to talk about later is huge budgets and how do you control, there's never been an audit of the Department of Defense, a fiscal audit, in which we're trying to get to the point of being able to do that. But there's a lot of responsibility we're talking over $700 billion.
It's a huge amount.
It's a huge amount. And I would say that the challenge comes into efficiency versus effectiveness, which are one of these rubs that we can't run exactly like a business in that everything is Lean Six Sigma down to, you know, the most efficient, because sometimes you never want to be in a fair fight and you go for effectiveness over efficiency. And but it's how do you find that right balance and then ensure transparency, because these are huge amounts of money that the American taxpayer is paying for.
This is actually a great transition, because you yourself, as I mentioned earlier, you were a senior liaison to Congress, the Army senior liaison. And most people, when they think about the Army, well, it's obviously technically part of the executive branch. And so the connection to government in most minds is through that branch rather than the legislative branch. However, of course, Congress has the power of the purse and oversees budgetary matters. What were the roadblocks? Why hasn't there been an audit? How is Congress working with this budget, and what was your time like?
Yeah, I would first say that Congress has a central role with the armed forces that goes well beyond budget. Article 1, Section 8 gives them the authority over size, policies, composition, the right to declare war, even. The president, as commander-in-chief, has certain responsibilities under Article 2 of the Constitution, but the military has two masters. And certainly in the budgetary realm, it is very important to Congress that the dollars that they are appropriating, that the president signs as the federal budget, are used well. And so there's tremendous oversight through not only the committees, but through reports and watchdog organizations.
So they don't just rubber stamp it, because that's the sense that's a popular sense, is that what the military wants, what the president wants, military gets. What is that not the case?
Yeah, well, it is. Really, when the budget comes from the president to Congress, Congress buys about 98% of it. Really arguing only a couple percent. Now, a couple percent is many billions of dollars,
right,
when you're talking 700 billion. But it is not, you're right, but it's not all rubber stamped. Some of that stuff just has to be spent.
Yeah.
54%, you know, of budget spent on personnel issues, you know, that gets spent. So you're really not arguing about that. You have to keep the lights on and all of those kinds of things. But it is not rubber stamped. The posture hearings in the spring there's a lot of grilling that goes on. What are you actually doing with this? What's your plan? Show me how the out years go. Justify what you're doing. And that is exactly appropriate under our Constitution for Congress to ask those questions. And the services take it very, very seriously on what they're doing and how they're planning on using those resources.
The budget continues to expand. You know, a few years ago, it was a $600 billion budget. Now it's closer to $700 billion. Is it all justified?
Well, you know, you need the budget for what you're being asked to do. Right now, you know, the U.S. Army is in 80-some countries around the world. Mm. You know, we're being asked to do an awful lot. Are there alternative futures that you could think of that would allow national defense to cost less? Absolutely. But it's what does the American people want us to do? A bigger concern for me is that when we talk about the federal budget, we're really only arguing about 27% of the federal budget, the federal discretionary budget. Mandatory spending, you know, third rail of American politics, nobody's really taken that on, but it is growing every year and making that discretionary pot smaller. The other thing is interest on the debt. And by 2025, it's predicted that interest on the debt on an annual payment as part of our budget will equal the DOD budget. So with the growing of mandatory spending, the growing of interest on the debt, the only way to square that in federal discretionary, of which defense is over 50%, is either raise revenues, more deficit spending, or cuts. And all of them, you know, have their attractors and detractors. So it is a difficult issue.
Are the roadblocks, you mentioned Congress does grill you, does take an active role in looking over this budget. The Congress, and this is not just today, Congress has struggles with its approval rating from the population and the people, and so it seems like there's a story you're telling that doesn't square quite with what the people think, which is that Congress isn't doing its job, it's not doing oversight. What is What are the obstacles here, and what are the challenges that you faced?
Yeah, this is a wonderful question. And when I talk to groups about Congress, I say, listen, I never met a congressman who I didn't personally like, who I didn't think was working really hard, either party. But they're in a very tough situation. Congress right now has a 17% approval rating, but the average congressman, an incumbent gets reelected at 96% rate. So we love our congressman. We hate Congress. What happens if you vote on any kind of compromise on immigration or gun control? You're going to be beat in your next primary because 84% of the seats in Congress are safe. They're either going to be Republican or they're going to be Democrat. And therefore, the only threat to you, if you're a member of Congress, is from inside your own party. And if at the primary, you're going to get outlefted if you're a Democrat, or you're going to get outrighted if you're a Republican, if you have strayed too far away from, you know, the base, if you will. There's only 16% of Congress who are rewarded for finding that 51% compromise. That's not enough to get bills passed. And so we wonder why there's not a lot of legislation being passed. It's because Congress is doing exactly what their individual constituents want them to do.
Now, you mentioned you teach a class on civ-mil relations, and that is, of course, the relationship between the military and, you know, civil society, non-service members, non-military service members, of which this kind of relationship, the oversight of Congress is a part, and so is the executive branch oversight over the military. What are the major issues in your class that you speak about that are maybe different from that, or that other that is not the thing that comes to mind most?
Yeah, I look at civ-mil relations as bigger than that. I look at it as a triangle. You've got the people, you've got the military, and you've got government. So the leg between the people and the military is about those shared societal ties. Does the military reflect society? Is there the development of a warrior caste? Is the military demographically look like the rest of the country? All of those kind of issues. The second leg is about the military to government, and it's about civil control of the military arm of force. That's where the budget and oversight of the budget comes through, and those different mechanisms. The leg of the triangle that worries me most in civ-mil relations is between the people and the government. You notice military is not even part of that, but that's the debate that has to happen over when are you going to go to war? For what purposes are you going to go to war? How is your military going to be resourced and manned? That debate, in my opinion, has been silent for the last 17 years. We're just not hearing it. We're paying for deficit spending. The authorization for the use of military force that has us in places like Niger was passed on September 14th, 2001, and not been updated since. And so that's the part that I worry about. Am I worried that the military is becoming so disconnected from society that it's going to be like Caesar crossing the Rubicon? Absolutely not. Am I worried that civil-military relations have degraded to the point or the military will not be responsive to the president or Congress? Absolutely not. But I am worried about there's no debate about what's our military for. So you asked, how big is big enough? You know, $700 billion is a lot. My question is, what do you want it to do?
The element that you're talking about is really a public debate outside of Congress. People who themselves vote for Congress and pressure Congress to do certain things that they're not. There isn't a public debate about use of military force.
Yeah, so in political science terms, there's an incredibly strong equilibrium between Republicans and Democrats not to have that debate, not to have another vote on the authorization for the use of military force, because it could be used against them in a future election, not to have the debate with the American people. President Bush said, you know, continue to go to the mall, you know, continue to live your life normally, don't think about this. So you have a thank you for your service, which is greatly appreciated by the military, but without the debate about where you should be going and what should you be doing. That has been very silent. And in my opinion, that's a missing link. You know, it was the point of Rachel Maddow's book, Drift, or Rosa Brooks' book, about how everything has become war, you know, and it looks like all you have is a hammer, so all the problems have to be nails.
And so what do we do? How do we fix that? Is that, to me, that also partly does feel like is that not related to a demographic issue? If the military is drawing increasingly for certain types of parts of civil society that there's a disconnect, that people just aren't, you know, people who come from this state or this town or this demographic just don't know that many people in the military. Right. So they don't think about it.
So over 50% of our recruits come from five states.
Right.
So it is demographically not as diverse as the military should be, representing a democratic society. Is that a threat to our democratic values? Absolutely not. What it does do is increases this lack of knowledge. So in 1979, 75% of Congress were veterans. They intuitively knew the military. They could participate in these kind of debates and understand what's going on. That's 18% right now in Congress. And so that same level of discourse isn't happening. But it's also not happening with their constituents, because these are really tough issues that no one really wants to vote on because they'll be held to account. Yeah. By their constituents. And so I blame the American people for a lack of debate. I don't blame Congress.
But don't you also, I mean, shouldn't you also blame Congress? Because if they're afraid that it's going to bite them in the butt later, and I think I can say butt, this is a family show, can't we blame them for saying, you know, for not being willing to say, no, this is what I think, this is what we should do, we should have this vote? Right? I mean, that feels to me that...
Yeah, the easy button is lack of moral courage. Let's just hit that one. You know, Congress ought to show some moral courage and talk about these hard issues. You know, that's a lot easier for us to say than them to do when their constituents are not allowing, you know, compromise. I look at, you know, gun control or something like that. You know, should everybody have automatic weapons with 30-round magazines? I'd say, you know, what do you need them for?
Yeah.
Well, hunting. I said, then work on your marksmanship. I mean, if you need a 30-round magazine, come on.
Yeah.
There's very reasonable compromises on immigration, on education reform, but it's difficult. There's no constituency in Congress that gets rewarded for compromise anymore. And so by their voters. In fact, they get punished for that, and that causes there to be, you know, the 114th Congress only passed 329 bills, you know, and that is a dropping number of legislative action.
To get the public engaged about this stuff, to me, intuitively, it feels, you know, how do you get people? I come from Kansas. You know, how do you get somebody from my hometown, Kansas City, to care about the situation in Syria or Darfur or all these places? Is it that people don't feel those things are important? Is it that people care about certain social issues now more than they do about foreign policy? And how do we hold town halls? What do we do to engage this public?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point. So a lot of pressure goes on to the military. You know, all of the commanders of Fort Riley or Fort Leavenworth there in Kansas told, get off and talk to civic groups, you know, get out and talk, as if the responsibility for informing the American public lies with the military to tell them about that. I think that's a component of it. But I also think that elected officials, who are the ones choosing, telling us, you know, where we're going to go, and here's what you're going to do in places like Niger, they owe their constituents to also be part of that education. And that, you know, so it's a whole team effort to do. I think that how we recruit is very important also. I am not an advocate for the draft, but those that are advocates for the draft put that exact issue first and foremost in their mind, as reconnect Americans in certain geographical areas that have no connection to the military with the military.
Yeah, because then they're going to have to really think about whether or not they want to go into this war or they want to use the military in this certain way. There are some appealing elements to that argument. And if you don't have a draft, the question is how do you get at that?
Right. And so 82%, the number one indicator if a young man or woman is going to join the military, the number one indicator is whether that person has familial ties, father or mother, brother or sister, in the military already. And so you run the risk of the military becoming a family business and further insulating the military from the society that it protects and making that education, mutual sharing of values more and more difficult.
And what about media? I mean, the private industry and media and journalism feel to me another area. I don't know if that would be a third or a fourth kind of, I guess that's technically part of civil society, but in some ways it feels like a little bit different, you know, from the government, military, and civil society triangle. They are such important elements of the functioning of society and information distribution and debate. Are they not engaged enough? Is there more that they could do?
I think, you know, everybody's got a role in this. You know, one of the challenges that media falls underneath is the polarization of news nowadays. And so, you know, news from one part of the spectrum, very different than news from the other part of the spectrum. And so, you know, that is a challenge that, that they have. And the American people not getting a well-balanced understanding of what is truth out there, rather than just what is given to them, you know, on cable networks.
Now I want to transition to an element of this, which is, it's not civil relations in the traditional sense, but it is the transition from serving in military to civilian life. And you've obviously done this recently. You've made that transition. And I was curious, has that been tough? And do you still use military and government jargon in everyday life? Like, do you refer to your office as your base and yourself as a station chief? Do you feel guilty if you aren't at work at 5 a.m.? What's it like to transition from the military to civilian life?
Well, you know, it's all I have known for 37 years, 4 as a cadet at West Point and 33 and a half as an officer afterwards. And so transitioning to civilian life, I joked about picking out a shirt and a tie and a jacket combination. But I still get up early. I still feel guilty if I'm not doing some kind of physical education. I still keep in my hair shorter than most, you know, would think.
Not as short as mine, but mine's not a choice.
You know, I'm not going to, you know, grow a beard. You know, there's a few things that's just not me after that many years of doing it. But the transition has actually been very good. Harvard has been a wonderful place to make that transition. Being able to teach and engage with really, really bright folks is an absolute treat, and it has made that transition very easy for me.
You know, a friend of mine who went to West Point had told me that they were only allowed to chew something like 3 to 5 bites. This was just as a first year cadet. They were only allowed to chew 3 to 5 bites per bite. Is that actually true? And is that how you chew your food today?
No, so I do eat faster than I probably should. It's probably, you know, healthy to eat, but I look at eating as more a necessity that I have to do rather than, you know, a pleasurable part of the day that I just need to savor every single bite. So it's very much a utilitarian. But at West Point, everybody's memory of what they went through is always more grandiose and embellished than what it actually is. You know, there's no hazing going on. You saw the Air Force Academy when they found out that there was some potential hazing on that involved the swim team, immediately launched an investigation, immediately holding these people to account. All the service academies do that. And so everybody has their memories of what they believe they went through. Having been the commandant, I feel very confident that, so my daughter graduated from West Point in 2017. People ask, aren't you worried about, you know, sexual assault in the military? And I said, I was so much more comfortable her being at West Point because I know the oversight. I know where she is at 11:30 every night, and that's in her room. I know how much emphasis is put on treating everybody with dignity and respect. So I was very comfortable when she went there. So, you know, these stories that you hear are often stories.
Would that have been the case 30 years ago? Or do you think the Army has made steps forward in that realm?
Oh, the Army has absolutely made steps and we have much more to go. I mean, the fact now that there's still a debate about implementation of transgender policy means we have more distance to go. You know, we made the argument about military effectiveness back in the 90s and why we should not allow open service of homosexuals. You know, that's just old thinking, and I think that the military is better for the inclusion and the diversity. And I think that we still constantly have to find where we're not doing things as well as we should and keep getting better. Yeah. The service academies have absolutely gotten better in the last 30 years, and they were better 30 years ago than they were 60 years ago. But there's always room for improvement.
The last kind of question I want to ask is about the state of affairs today. And there's certainly the 2016 election signaled a challenge of many long-held axioms of American foreign policy and certainly military policy. When do we defend our allies? Is it worth canceling joint military exercises with South Korea? Is NATO that important? I mean, these were things that had really not been challenged in such a public way by the political class until recently. But now the military is a big organization. It's got 700, 800, you know, overseas bases and posts. As we mentioned, we talked about a $700 billion budget. There are strong relationships military has built over at least the last several decades. How easy is it to turn that ship around? Or I guess another way of putting it is how sticky are our partnerships abroad?
Yeah, I think they're very sticky. You know, the famous axiom that the only thing worse than fighting with allies is fighting a war without allies. The military knows that absolutely intuitively. We work all over the world to build relationships, regardless of who's in the White House. We're always going to try building relationships. And our allies and partners know that that we're dependable on those issues. And so, yeah, the super tanker doesn't turn on a dime. Yeah. And I think for good reason in any of the directions. But it has been my my life's honor to have served in the military, and I'm just thrilled to be at Harvard now.
Yeah. Do you quick follow up on that? Do you feel? I mean, does that still worry? I mean, even if it still is hard to change directions, does that challenge? I mean, I guess in the abstract, it's good to discuss these things, and it's good to have civil debate, you know, about these issues. But is that something that does worry you? Does concern you a little bit? Do you think there was that we should be continuing the course that we have for as we have over the last several decades?
Yeah, I think that America is best when it's leading internationally. I think that we, you know, our value sets, while they shouldn't be imposed on everyone, certainly provide that beacon on the hill for the world. I think that we do ourselves a disservice when we retreat to isolationism. Not only in our ability to influence our future, but for our sake as well. You know, no one is trying to emigrate into Russia. And yet America, you know, immigration, we call it a problem. It's a strength of our country. It just shows that this is still the land of opportunity. And I think that we should lead.
Well, General Rapp, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. It has been a lot of fun chatting with you, and I know the Kennedy School is very lucky to have you here.
I look forward to doing this again.
Office Hours was produced by the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.